Tough Message. I'm Isaac Dobert. Today's guest, Eric Holder, the former Attorney General and now the chair of the National Democratic Redistricting Committee. It's the big Democratic effort to try to make a difference in gerrymandering, which they argue is a big part of the reason why they're in such bad shape in the House and state legislatures around the country. To be clear, they'd probably be in bad shape anyway, but this does seem to make it worse. One of the things that struck me about Holder is his transformation from the restrained lawman into the active political presence on the campaign trail. There was always something clearly not so beneath the surface with him that seemed as if he was holding it in. I remember one particular committee hearing where he sat in his chair behind that wooden table you always see and just got to the point where he couldn't take it anymore, and he just started ripping into all the Republican members who were going after
political
him.
Political point making. And that is the kind of thing that, you and your side, I guess, have the ability to do if that's what you want to do. It is the thing that I think turns people off about Washington. While we have very serious problems, we're still involved in this political gamesmanship.
Well, Mr. Attorney General,
when we sat down to record in the conference room in a church in Richmond, Virginia, where he'd just been going on to the congregation about the Orange Man, he admitted to me it's a change and one that he still is getting used to himself. He's still not the most natural presence on the campaign trail. But though he was out there in Virginia for the Democratic statewide ticket, his main job politically is this new group, and it's raising money, getting attention, and being the connection to Barack Obama, who has identified this group as the main mission politically for him of his post-presidency. You can check out my article up on the website at politico.com for more on what they're doing and how its mission has already shifted and what they think they're going to be doing going into next year. They say this is going to be a $30 million effort, and it's going to get intense. We're putting this up on Election Day, after all, but we're already looking ahead to what's going to be a much bigger and more complicated election year over 2018, and the redistricting group and Holder seems like it's going to be a big part of it. But first, subscribe, rate us on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast platform. Catch up on old episodes like last week's double bill of Preet Bharara and Nancy Pelosi, two really great conversations. And what's coming up? A fake president episode with Alec Baldwin on his new fake Trump biography, and Bradley Whitford, that's Josh Lyman from The West Wing, about what Jed Bartlett would think of Trump and how the election shifted his own sense of activism. Follow me on Twitter at Isaac Dobert, and like me on Facebook, and keep those emails coming to isaac@politico.com. And now my conversation with Eric Holder, which went all the way from talking about meeting Muhammad Ali to the line he thinks Trump could cross that would be grounds for impeachment. Let's start by reading a tweet from a few weeks ago when it was in the midst of when the president was talking about how President Obama didn't call the troops' families. And you wrote, "Stop the damn lying. You're the president." You just, in the church here, referred to President Trump as the Orange Man. Feels like you've been liberated. When you were Attorney General, you didn't do politics, right? That's part of what being AG is.
Yeah, you don't do politics when you're Attorney General, but as a private citizen and as a defender of the Obama legacy, I'm free to say what I want and to say it in the way that I'd like to. And that particular tweet really offended me, because he, in essence, was saying that Barack Obama didn't care about the people who served under him, who sacrificed so much. And I remember that day, that night, actually, at Dover Air Force Base.
Right, there was a photo that you tweeted with it of the two of you at Dover Air Force
Base. It was cold. I remember that. And I remember President Obama meeting each one of those families, interacting with them, comforting widows, trying to explain things to youngsters who were going to be there without their dads. And it really offended me that that President Trump would have taken out after President Obama in that way. And it was one of those kind of instinctive, almost emotional things where I just wasn't going to let him say that about my guy.
Is it weird, though, to let that part of yourself loose? It was buttoned up for a long time.
Yeah, it's interesting because people who know me think of that as a different person. And people who are now meeting me say, well, boy, you seem a lot looser. You're a lot funnier, But when you're in these roles, I think you have a responsibility to conduct yourself in appropriate ways. As Attorney General of the United States, there were certain things I might have felt that I couldn't express in the way that I wanted to. There's a certain dignity, I think, that you're supposed to bring to the office.
And when people see this now and say, oh, well, he was political all the time as an AG, you know, the accusations, I mean, you were censured as AG. The mm-hmm. Republicans went after you pretty heavily because mm-hmm. they thought you were not doing the job well.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like they proved them right, maybe?
No, not at all. I think what I'm doing now is really a continuation of that which I did as Attorney General, speaking out for a more fair, a more just, a more equal America, talking about protecting voting rights, talking about criminal justice reform. The things I did as Attorney General were consistent with the obligations that I had while I occupied that office. It wasn't political.
But calling the president the Orange Man?
All right. I probably would not have done that while I was Attorney General, you know, and I didn't have an orange man who I was serving under. But I mean, I would not have said that about a former president, for instance, while I was as Attorney General. But now, you know, I'm just a citizen, you know, and I've got the full range of my voice back.
You said that people in church, you were saying people could look at Barack Obama being elected and look at Donald Trump being elected and say, is this the same country?
Mm-hmm.
Does it feel to you like it's the same country?
I think it feels like it's the same country that is in a different space. The election of Barack Obama in 2008 was all about hope and change. I know those sound like, you know, just campaign slogans, but really that was the feeling about that election. I think people tend to forget the optimism that was generated by his election. Donald Trump's election was more about division and fear. And the election was about that, and the way in which he has governed has been about that.
Is it something that you guys didn't anticipate or didn't recognize was going on in the country? Is this a backlash to Obama? Is this that you guys didn't address what Donald Trump obviously tapped into?
Well, you know, we can never forget that he didn't win the popular vote.
Still won 62 million votes and the Electoral College, right?
That's true. But he polls at, you know, 35-40%, something like that. So the majority of Americans, even now, don't necessarily agree either with his policies or the way, and the number's even greater, the way in which he expresses himself. He has given license, however, to a small part of the electorate, of the population, to say things that they might not have said before, to do things that they might not have done before. The president sets a moral tone, and I think in that regard, President Trump has not done the job we expect of our leaders.
But was there? It seems like there was more going on, maybe under the surface in America, and under the surface of American politics, if the surface is Barack Obama being mm-hmm. twice elected president, then most people anticipated. Most people realized at the time. Do you think that that's right, or is it just 2016 was a breaking point? Is it that you guys didn't address what the problems were that were festering and brewing? Mm-hmm. That again, that obviously mm-hmm. were there.
There's always an underside, you know, and the question is, does that underside feel that it has the ability to express itself, to do things? No, the election of Barack Obama did not magically transform us as a people and eradicate bigotry, eradicate, you know, neo-Nazis and you know, white nationalists. They were still there, but they didn't feel empowered in the way that I think they do now.
The president's fault?
I think partially. It's not totally. I can't put it all on him. But I think in answer to your earlier question, the question, you know, is this a different America? I think we're going to know on the basis of the election we see here in Virginia in 2017, what happens in the midterms in 2018, and ultimately what happens in 2020. What will the United States, what will the electorate do with regard to these policies that have been put in place with the expressions that we've heard come from you know, the mouths of leaders of this administration.
And if Republicans win, then it is a different country. Like, to follow through that thought, right?
Well, it depends. It depends. I mean, you know, I wouldn't want to say that one election means, you know, something. Virginia is a very important election, but I wouldn't say that what happens in Virginia by itself will be an indication. But if you see a 2017 go one way, a 2018 go a certain way, a 2020 go a certain way, then I think you can start to draw conclusions.
I wonder if you could tell just was thinking about this and the Muhammad Ali story of mm-hmm. yours when you met him.
Yeah, right. Yeah. He is right after he won the title. He was still Cassius Clay. He had not formally changed his name. And Malcolm X lived about four blocks from my house. My brother came into a candy store right up the block and said, "Hey, Cassius Clay is at Malcolm X's house." And so we ran out there. And he was there, and he was the largest human being I'd ever seen in my life. I'm 12 years old, something like that, skinny kid. And I asked him, because people forget, at the weigh-in, his pulse rate was off the charts. He was ranting and raving at Sonny Liston, and I asked him, and people had written, he was scared. And I said, "Were you scared of, you know, Sonny Liston at the weigh-in?" And he looked down at me, and balled up his fist, and he kind of put it in my face, and it was the biggest thing I think I'd ever seen, and I just kind of meekly said, "No, I didn't think you were scared." But he gave me his autograph, which I had on a piece of brown paper from a paper bag, kept secure in a little book that I had, only to find out that my late mother, who I loved dearly, in one of her periodic cleanings, threw it out.
My mom threw out my whole comic book collection.
Yeah, so. I had a collection of Sports Illustrateds, you know, gone, all gone.
You know Malcolm X? Did you see him around the neighborhood?
Would see him every now and again. I never met him.
Right, but I mean, you were 12, right?
Yeah, but I saw him every now and again.
What were your impressions of him?
Well, you know, it's interesting. At the time, Malcolm was seen as kind of like, ooh, he's one of those black Muslims. And it wasn't until I read his autobiography, when I was in high school, that I got a true sense of the man, and to read about his journey from, you know, petty thief to race hater to a person who took people for what they were and saw people as individuals, and kind of freed himself from the racism that had so encompassed his life. I saw a different person at the end of reading that biography than I kind of knew or was told of when I was 12 or so.
So just over a year ago, let's fast forward. Mm-hmm. We're going to go all the way over all the attorney general years too.
Okay.
How you get involved in redistricting.
Mm-hmm.
You get a call from Barack Obama, mm-hmm. who is, in addition to being your former boss, a mm-hmm. friend of yours, and he says he wants you to talk about redistricting.
Yep.
And you go to the White House and you meet with him about this. What's the pitch that he gives to you to say you need to be the one to do this?
I'm not sure there was a huge pitch as much as, you know, I was looking for something to continue doing after I left office. He was thinking about what was he going to do in his post-presidency. And I think we probably had just a conversation made the determination, yeah, that I would lead the effort. And he said this was going to be his chief political activity in his post-presidency. Because I said, you know, I'll do this, but I think, you know, I can be more effective if you're involved. And he has been involved.
He's involved how? He's done one fundraiser.
Yeah, done fundraisers. We have, I guess he's released a statement now. We have Organizing for Action, which is now a part of our grassroots effort. He'll be, you know, more involved as we go along. We're still pretty much a startup. We're only, I guess, 8, 9, 10 months old. But he's going to be, he has been involved, and he'll be more involved.
Did he make any commitments to you about what that involvement would look like, or he just said it's going to be my main post-presidency political mission?
I mean, it's interesting. You know, he and I, we don't talk in specifics a lot. I mean, we share a worldview, and so a lot of things between us are unsaid. And I know that if I need him, he'll be there. He knows that, having said this is going to be his chief activity in his post-presidency, that he's going to be there, and he'll come up with creative things, you know. So he's helped with messaging, you know, conversations.
You ran through the PowerPoint with him. It's funny, two people who are friends, mm-hmm. a former president, a former attorney general, and you did a PowerPoint presentation for him, which is the one that you give to donors.
Right. Yeah.
Must have been a little weird to do that.
Well, you know, it's kind of like, you know, you're kind of briefing the principal. That's kind of what I was doing. It just happened to be the attorney general, former attorney general, briefing the former president.
You are a lawyer. You're a guy who thinks in terms of court cases and mm-hmm. prosecutions and all that. Why not join the Supreme Court case that was heard in at the beginning of October about redistricting reform and trying to make for nonpartisan gerrymandering?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I thought that it wasn't that I didn't join it formally, but I certainly spoke about it and have continued to speak about it. And there are any number of ways in which you can express support for, you know, a particular matter that is before the court. And as Attorney General, I think, as a former Attorney General, I think I have the unique ability to lend my support, make my views known in ways that other lawyers might not. Other lawyers may have to sign briefs in order to stake out a position. I have the ability to, for instance, speak to people like you, you know, people in the media, and amplify my views in that way. But it's been clear from the very beginning that I've been in support of, you know, the plaintiffs in that case.
You want that case to get to some change in the gerrymandering process.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have, you know, we have rules as a result of the Voting Rights Act with regard to racial gerrymandering. But when it comes to partisan gerrymandering, we really don't have those same kind of rules. And it seems to me that we need to put up some standards there. I mean, there's a political component to, you know, redistricting. I think that I can find that acceptable. But I think you can go too far.
Yeah.
And I certainly think in the Wisconsin case that the Republicans went too far.
Part of the argument that Chief Justice Roberts voiced in his questions that day was, well, I mean, if you do this and you put it in the courts, then every time that there's a court challenge or every time there's a map that somebody doesn't like, there's going to be a court challenge, and then it's going to make the courts look like they're Democratic or Republican based case by case. You don't make much of that argument.
No, I think with all due respect to the Chief Justice, if you decide this case against the plaintiffs, you're making a political statement there. You're in essence saying that what the Republicans did in Wisconsin was okay. The other thing is that if the court puts out—
But then you're making a political statement the other way if you decide—
No,
right?
You could simply be saying that in this particular case, the Republicans went too far. These are the standards that have to be applied. Now, it will mean that in the short term, there will be cases that will come up to the lower courts, and maybe one or two of those will wind their way to the Supreme Court. But over time, if you set out some guidelines, people will conform their conduct to those guidelines, and the Supreme Court will not be inundated with these cases. So I respectfully disagree with the
Chief
Justice.
There was also this sense that he had that, oh, well, it's going to politicize the courts. But I think a lot of people look at that and say, well, the courts are sort of politicized already, right?
Yeah, I don't think the courts are as politicized as people think. But I think, you know, it is simply because you have to make a decision in a political case doesn't mean that you should avoid that. I mean, that's what the courts are for, to decide ultimately what the law is, what the standards should be.
How come Republicans have been so much better at this over the years? It seems like this is yet another example of the Republican Party realizing how to play the game well in a way that Democrats just are not able to catch up to.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I'm not sure what the answer to that is, but I think it's clear that with regard to redistricting, certainly in the 2011-2010 time period, Republicans simply did a better job than Democrats. And what we're doing at the National Democratic Redistricting Committee is to ensure that this party, when it comes to the redistricting after the census in 2020, that we are in a position to have an influence that we didn't have at the beginning of this decade. So I'm not sure exactly why it is, but this is, I think, a recognition that we have to do a better job than we did, you know, 8 or 9 years ago.
I mean, I have talked to Republicans about this effort, and some of whom are directly involved in mm-hmm. their efforts and some not. And what they say is like, yeah, okay, sure, go ahead. Give it a shot, Holder. Mm-hmm. This is, we've got this wired better than you guys are ready to.
Well, you know, that's their view. we'll see. I think that given the interest that has been expressed in the NDRC, given the support that we have gotten from people, given the fact that we've had the ability to raise the consciousness of not only Democrats, but people around the country about what redistricting means. You know, they were doing their redistricting in kind of in secret, in the dark, you know, and people didn't really kind of focus on it. Now we're saying, all right, this is, you know, redistricting means this. It has an impact on your life, your day-to-day life, American citizens, you know, anti-choice laws, crazy gun laws, voter suppression laws.
You think that argument's breaking through?
Yeah, I do.
How do you measure that?
Just from the reception that I get when I go out and talk about it, things that I'm reading about, you know, in various periodicals, things that I see online, I think there is a focus on this issue now that there was not before. And I think, very frankly, that's as a result of our existence and the fact that we have pushed this issue out there. I think that people will be looking in 2021 at the redistricting process in a way that they did not in 2011. I mean, the ordinary Americans, you know, citizens in various states will be looking to see what happens in state legislatures.
I mean, I wrote about the NDRC when the group launched about a year ago. Yep. And there was – it got some attention when the article came out. But then afterwards, we can see the metrics of traffic. We started to see – interest mm-hmm. on that article go up after the election. Mm-hmm. It seems like Democrats all of a sudden started to get real about what had happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, the Trump election has done a variety of things. You know, people, one of the things when it comes to NDRC is that people concerned about the direction of the country have tried to figure out, well, how do I channel this frustration? How do I channel this concern? And we've gotten, I think, a lot of people who've said, you know, all right, this redistricting thing, that's a way in which I can focus my concerns, focus my attention, potentially make a difference.
It's not sexy. It's not the kind of thing that people are going to hold signs in the streets like, no gerrymandering.
You might not get to that. But when we announced that, I said I thought it was my job to try to make it a sexy issue. And what I meant by that was, again, raise the consciousness of people. And I think in some ways that we have done that. I'm not sure it's going to get people into the streets with placards. Although I would say this, if a state legislature does what Wisconsin did, what North Carolina has done, and, you know, there is some time period for people to, you know, review these things instead of like 48 hours or whatever, that, yeah, you actually could see demonstrations, you know, in 2021 about unfairly drawn lines.
And meanwhile, there's this chunk of Democrats who look at what you're doing and they say like, okay, yeah, it's another group and it's got money and whatever. And it seems to me like part of that is that there are some Democrats who feel like they're just going to lose this battle and it's sort of internalized. Do you find that there are people who just kind of accepted that they will lose here?
Yeah, I mean, there are always going to be people like that. And, you know, some of them are Democrats, you know. But that's not how I'm wound. And that's not how the people who I think were involved in this effort are wound. Whether it's an uphill fight or it's an easy fight, there are certain fights that are worth having. And it seems to me that this is one of them. You know, I mean,
how, and your line was democracy is under attack,
yeah,
right, with this.
Yeah, I think that's
right. Is it just gerrymandering that makes you say democracy is under
attack? No, I think democracy is under attack both with regard to gerrymandering and also with regard to these voter suppression efforts that that we have seen. And, you know, and what I would remind these people who think that, you know, we can't win this is that, well, how improbable is it? In 2005, if you had said, you know what, I think that the next president of the United States is going to be an African American. Now, how improbable would that have seemed even then? And, you know, the improbable sometimes happens. Things that seem
Yeah, but there's not going to be like a Shepherd Fairey blue and red poster of gerrymandering. There was, right? Like, it was hope with Obama. Well, it was a movement in that way. Right?
Yeah, there was a movement in that way. And the people who supported Barack Obama and who are now part of Organizing for Action are focused on issues of gerrymandering, redistricting, and fair line drawing. And so, yeah, it might not get the publicity. It might not arouse the same intensity of emotion that his candidacy did, but I think people write us off at their peril. I mean, you know, their big donors have been putting big money after, you know, we announced and after they kind of saw what we were doing into their own efforts. And if they're, you know, so confident about their abilities to do what they say, as you've just reported, why are you doing what you're doing? They're worried. No, they're worried about us. They might not say it, but they are.
So define success for me. But when we get to 2021, what does that mean? Because you're staring down at not only a lot of races that you have to try to win here, mm-hmm. but, you know, Ohio is a state where you'd like to make a difference. There's a supermajority in the state Senate in Ohio of Republicans. Mm-hmm. So that means you really need a revolution there in terms of who gets elected. North Carolina is another one. These are states that I right. know are sure. the priority list for mm-hmm. NDRC. Wisconsin is the one you brought up and is mm-hmm. Where that Supreme Court challenge is focused. There's a supermajority in the Assembly, right, at this point. You need to win so many elections to start chipping away at this that it seems like this is so high of a mountain that maybe success is just winning three seats and slightly changing things? Or?
Well, I think success starts with a good census effort. I mean, you start there to make sure that people are counted, make sure that the census effort is adequately funded and adequately staffed.
Are you worried about that?
Yes. I really am because, you know, I think, you know, people are expressing concerns about the underfunding. The person who runs the census, the director, I guess, quit. I don't think he's been replaced as yet. And I'm worried that we will not use the appropriate methods to make sure that all people are counted, people of color, people who are poor, people in certain areas. So we start there. So that's one of the ways in which I define success, a good census. You also have to understand that between now, I guess, and next year, there'll be 322, I think that's the number, state legislative seats that will be decided. In the Trump era, although to be fair, what we have seen during American history is that the party in power in the White House tends to lose seats in the state legislature.
It certainly happened for Barack Obama.
It did. And I think that the dissatisfaction with the Trump administration is going to accelerate that movement away from the Republican Party. And then we've got another cycle in 2020. So I think that, I think that we can position ourselves by 2021 to have sufficient numbers of people in state legislatures and in governor's houses that we can ensure a much more fair redistricting process than we had in 2011.
And are you committed to this for through 2021, beyond? What's your sense of your role in it?
Yeah, I'm committed to this, to see how long. I've not thought about even when I'm going to separate myself from the effort. As I said, this is consistent with the work that I did as Attorney General. When I remember the day that I announced that I was leaving in the White House, I said I was leaving the job as AG, but I would never leave the work. And this, for me, is consistent with what I call that day, the work.
You said recently that you might run for office one day. You were asked, and you said, yeah. So you live in Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. which means that your options are city council, mayor, D.C. attorney general, or president. So which one should I put you down for?
Or neighborhood advisory board.
Oh, yeah, you can do that.
I could do that.
Yeah.
I could do that.
You ready to do that?
Yeah, that's possible, sure. I mean, who knows? I mean, I think at this point, my focus is on the NDRC, and we'll see what happens.
Should we
after
dig
that.
Into like zoning issues in D.C.?
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, I'm
liquor
very,
licenses.
I'm really concerned. There's a building that might be going up that might have too many stories about three, four blocks from me. That's a big issue in my household.
Let's talk about your TV show for a
mm-hmm.
minute,
yeah.
because that seems like another. So you've got the legal work that you're doing. Mm-hmm. And you were involved in mm-hmm. Some of the Uber stuff. And television now.
Yep. Yeah.
How did that happen?
The writer and the producer of this show was probably going to appear called Main Justice approached me and said, you know, would I like to be involved in that project? And that sounded to me just kind of like fun.
Yeah.
And so we've been working on scripts and had a meeting with, you know, CBS and Jerry Bruckheimer. And so hopefully in the fall of next year, Main Justice will be on. I want everybody to watch it. And
is there going to be an Eric Holder character? It makes me think of in Law & Order, the DA, the original DA, was modeled on Bob Morgenthau, the former Manhattan District Attorney. So is there going to be that kind of character for you?
All I'll say is that there is an African-American Attorney General, and he's a lot younger than me.
Does he have a mustache?
He's single.
Involved in casting choices?
Has not been cast yet, but he's single. He's younger. And he's going to have some interesting issues that he's going to have to deal with. It might sound a little similar to the things that that I had to deal with.
Can we talk a little bit about the actual Justice Department, though?
Sure.
What is your take on Jeff Sessions? Is there anything that you would agree with him on?
Ooh, I'd have to think, I think, long and hard about that. I think when I hear his name, I immediately think about the things that he has done that I disagree with, you know, reversals of positions that he's taken when it comes to voting rights, criminal justice reform, even things that had wide support among Republicans as well as Democrats, you know, the changes I made with regard to asset forfeiture, you know, the protection of LGBTQ community, this, you know, where the Justice Department appears to be going with regard to this religious exemption. It's hard for me to, I can't think of many things where I could say I agree with him. I think my focus when I think about him is on the things that I find distressing.
A lot of incoming officials talk with cabinet officials or presidents, chief of staff, that talk with people who've held the job previously. Did he talk to you before he came on?
No, I did not. I think it's
Have you talked to him at all since he was nominated?
No, I haven't. But the point you make is a good one. I met with Attorney General Mukasey after I had been selected to be AG. I called him, and he was very gracious. And my chief of staff and I met with him and his chief of staff. Mark Phillip, who was then the deputy attorney general, also was generous with his time. And we went through just kind of a list of the things that were on their agendas, things that they were of concern to them, so that you didn't walk into the office on that first day just totally unawares. And I was more than prepared to do that, but never was asked to meet with them.
Do you, there are some Democrats, including Elizabeth.
Now, to be fair, I don't know if he met with Attorney General Lynch, who was my, you know, successor, my immediate successor. And so,
but you would have met with him if he'd asked.
Sure, of course.
Even though you don't agree with him on anything.
Sure, sure. I mean, at the end of the day, it's in my interest as an American citizen to have him succeed, to have Donald Trump succeed.
Do you agree with there are some Democrats, Elizabeth Warren very prominently in that floor speech in the Senate when he was up for his confirmation, that he is he pushes racist ideas, that he maybe is a racist himself?
I don't know about that. I'm you know, I don't like to use that term unless you've really got hard and fast proof. But I think he has done some things both in his career and as Attorney General that I think have been racially insensitive. And in some, there are times when I think he's racially unaware, and that I think is.
What does racially unaware mean?
Not understanding, realizing the impact of the policy positions that you are that you're implementing, what the effect of that is going to be in a particular community.
So one of the things that he did was he undid the Holder memo, which is about putting people up for prosecution facing mandatory minimums for drug crimes. Now there's the Sessions memo, which takes part. Is that an example to you, or have you seen the effects of that?
Yeah, I think that actually is a good example. I mean, when you understand that the prior policy that I reversed had a particularly negative impact, inappropriately negative impact on people of color, to go back to those failed policies, I think necessarily means that you're going to have that same impact. And again, I think that shows a certain degree of racial unawareness. Because if you're aware of that, if you're aware of the impact there, I think you'd have to think long and hard about reinstituting that which we showed did not work nearly as well as the things that we had put in place.
Some of your tweets have been directed at DOJ staff, things like stay strong, you're going to be tested. Do you think people should stay on the job at the Justice Department if they disagree with what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, that's an easy thing for me to say, and it's, I know, difficult for them to do. But yeah, I do think that the heart and soul of the Justice Department is the career people, you know, the career people who are there. I served for 12 years in the public integrity section when I first came out of law school, and I know what that's like to be a career person there. And so my hope would be that they will stay there, that they'll act in a way that's consistent with the best traditions of the department.
What happens if the president fires Bob Mueller?
That for me would be simply unacceptable.
And so unacceptable, what does that mean? You wouldn't like it?
Well, I wouldn't like it. I'd be extremely vocal about it. And I think that that would be something that I think would raise the possibility of impeachment.
This, with all of this, you talk about the Justice Department people working in the administration. You put a lot of your life into this work. And I wonder if you can just describe what it feels like to have, not just as like a policy issue, to have people reversing it, but personally, given the time, the years that you put into it, time away from your family, mm-hmm. must be really hard.
Yeah, it's a very difficult thing to watch, to see your life's work, or the culmination of your life's work, and which I thought was appropriate, which I thought was in the best traditions of progress in this country. I mean, I think, you know, this is sounding maybe a little immodest, but I thought I left this country a little more fair, a little more just, a little more equal. And to see those policies being reversed is distressing to me. I understand elections have consequences, but I think you can go sometimes too far. And I think that's what this administration is in the process of doing, and will take us back to a place that is not as good as the place where I think the Obama administration left the nation.
Is that where the President Obama feels about things?
He's a little more reticent, I think, than me to, you know, get out there publicly and say the things that I've said. But I think he probably feels, I know he feels that because, you know, you look at, you know, for instance, the Affordable Care Act.
It's 8 years of his life plus 2 years running, right? Like that's,
and
if nothing else, right, he must feel like this is this personal to him.
Yeah, and I, you know, you think about the people who never had the ability to get health care coverage who now do. I mean, the woman who is my barber, she's cut my hair for like, you know, 20, 30 years, never had health care. And because of the passage of the Affordable Care Act, I remember one day she came in and said, I got health coverage. She's at risk now, you know. Who knows what happens if this thing is sabotaged. And so, you know, Renee Smith, a wonderful woman, will be at risk in a way that she was before.
Do you get angry? Does he get angry? What's that feeling?
Yeah, I get both angry. I get disheartened, but it also gives me a sense of determination that, you know, I'm not going to crawl up in the fetal position and simply, you know, cry. I mean, I'm going to get out there and fight for the policies that were put in place, for the principles that I think should govern, and get this country back on track. You know, I'm not wound that way where I can simply take things like that. I still got a lot of years, I think, left in me, and I'm going to use those years, the power that I have, the ability that I have to influence people, to get this country back, get this country back on track.
All right, Eric Holder, thanks for taking the time.
All right, thanks for having me.
That was Eric Holder. Some of what I was expecting, and some that I wasn't. Thanks to Zach Stanton for producing and for help this week from Matt Sobosinski. Remember to subscribe. Coming up next, we have that special fake president episode with Bradley Whitford and Alec Baldwin. And then for a change of pace, we'll follow with former Defense Secretary Bill Perry, who at 90 basically spends his days dreaming of nuclear apocalypse. Catch you next time on Off Message.